Hello there, my name is Stephen Rumford and this is the Life and Death podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. This is a series in which we have honest conversations about life, death, bereavement and so much more. I have worked in palliative care for more than 20 years now, and in this series I sit down with all sorts of people to discuss what life and death means to them. In this episode, I'm joined by Annie Nicholson, also known as the Fandango Kid, a multidisciplinary artist whose work focuses on the complexities of life, death, and the human condition. Before we could delve into all of that, though, we had to sort out a few technical bits.
Sorry, I'm trying to turn down my headphones because they're coming through so loud. And it's just...
I know it's a faff, but it is worth it with the sound, with Olivia getting all of that right.
No, it's great. Thank you so much. I have no clue about any of this, so thank you.
Nor did I, honestly. This microphone really gives like an impression way beyond my technical level. But anyway, Annie's life and work has been inspired by a tragic incident in 2011. Which saw much of her immediate family killed in a helicopter crash in New York. The grief she experienced was beyond overwhelming, but she has dedicated her adult life into turning the tragedy into something positive. Annie really opened up to me about her grief. She discusses the grief raves that she has set up and the role that music, art and dance have all played in hers and other people's journeys. So morning, Annie. Hello.
Morning.
Annie, I wonder if we could just start. I looked at your website the other day when we knew we were doing the interview, and it looks like it has been, it's quite, what's the word I'm looking for? I think I want to use something ridiculous like fecund. I think I want to go to Lawrence for the kind of, just how rich your creative output seems to be. I mean, you can tell us, but it's a varied and... you know, with a very distinct voice, a very distinct aesthetic running all the way through it, but a rich and diverse set of outlets. But I suppose given the nature of this podcast, I wonder if you can talk about how you've made that transition from that private grieving, and I want to talk about the incident, but about that private grieving process to using your art in that more public sense.
Yeah, I think, I feel that there's a real responsibility both to yourself and to, you know, the public, if you're making work publicly and putting it out into the public realm, to have kind of gone through a period of therapy and healing. And, you know, I think trauma, the trauma of loss is something that really... you know, can totally derail you and it can kind of infiltrate every part of your being. So I do think I wasn't sort of interested and I didn't think it was fair to be sort of throwing out thoughts around trauma without having processed that myself. And, you know, I really recognized early on as a younger grieving person that there were no outlets really. Well, I couldn't find any outlets that were helpful to me in a sort of collective sense around grieving when I was 27, when this sort of all happened. And, you know, all my friends were still going out to parties and I was just sort of, my life had sort of flipped upside down and I just couldn't find networks that would receive that kind of grief where I could kind of publicly move forward with it. So I just sort of thought, okay, well, there is a gap here. And one day in my practice, I'd like to sort of maybe think about addressing that.
I suppose we've alluded to the incident, the crash. And it's funny, when I was looking through some of your other interviews, just by way of preparation, the helicopter crash in the East River in New York, it's as though that's a one-off, that's it, that's when the event happens. But obviously, it wasn't quite as simple as that. Now, would you be able to say a little bit about the incident? Because it is extraordinarily tragic in its hearing.
Yeah, I think, you know, there were, I guess, lots of forms of grief all at once. And I, you know, when you're in that, you're just literally trying to keep your head above water. But... Well, there were four of my family members in the accident and three of them who who died eventually, but my sister Sonia died instantly. Her partner, Helen, and my mum were in a coma. Helen died, I think, after about 10 days, despite, you know, many conversations about her recovering. So so much, you know, lying in the balance, so much sort of suspended pain and, you know, just a roller coaster of emotions. And then my mum actually fully recovered, and she died because of, there was some sort of acts of negligence at the end after 5 weeks. So I'd returned to London because I thought that she'd be following me and coming back, and that was, you know, we thought, okay, well, this has been horrendous, like the worst thing, but our mum has survived this. And I think at the point where my mum died, and my dad, you know, who was also in the accident, had a terminal illness, and he's now passed away. I was just like life is really hard, and I don't know if I'll, I guess I was sort of thought for a long time, I don't know if I'll survive this, because I don't have any reference points for this. I don't have any kind of tools for this, you know. And so, yeah, will it be possible? I don't know. It's quite unclear for a while.
Yeah, I mean, when I read through the an account you'd given of the, much like you have kind of done just now, I just found myself kind of getting... It's like waves. I mean, you were there, so I, you know, but even just to hear the story of that, you know, you know, when you go somewhere, I've done it in India, where you get washed by one big wave and you think, oh my goodness, how the hell do I, and then suddenly another one catching, you're just tumbling like in a washing machine of, that was my sense of what that, you know, as an imaginative act, to imagine what that must be like.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think everyone responds to this differently, and I couldn't have known. I had no idea, you know, how I would respond to it. It was totally unprecedented. I didn't have it, as I say, I didn't have any kind of guidebook or rule book for how to react to that. And there were times where it just sort of felt, yeah, you're in a total tidal wave of pain and exhaustion. And life can be really kind of unfair and painful and difficult for people. And I remember times when even, you know, the light felt different, you know, everything in my whole, it was like entering into a new world, you know, a whole new, not just a new era or a new chapter, but a new world, you know, because I think when you lose everything that you've come from, and then when I lost my dad, it's sort of like, okay, well, you really, really have to think about what your purpose is. And that was my way of dealing with it, and that's certainly not everybody's, but something that helped me. And, you know, I think it's a very non-prescriptive thing. It's not anything that I might offer is just a suggestion, because everyone, you know, has different circumstances and different ways to deal with things.
I really like that image that everything looks different, because it kind of is, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
it really is different. They're part of our sort of internal map of how and where things are, and when they come, when they're not there, the world is different. I think that's a very insightful thing to say about it, that it changes. I wonder if we can use that notion of how things look to go into some of your work. Where did that journey, because obviously you're a visual artist, graphic artist, I know you're interested in fabrics, textiles, clothing, but also music, and I really want to ask quite a lot about that. And for you, where was the first flowering after those first 2 years of just pain and you know, when it started to emerge as a creative process? How were the first few iterations of it for you?
Well, at that time, I was teaching, and that was, you know, very full time. But then because of this sort of need for structure, I'd also enrolled in a master's that would sort of hopefully bring me back to my practice. So I was going there once or maybe twice a week after my teaching job. And the first thing that we kind of had to do was like a group exhibition. And at that time, my dad was still alive. I'd asked him if he would want to record stories with me about my mum, because I realised, you know, that I knew I was going to lose him, and I kind of, there was a lot that I didn't know, a lot of gaps that I had, and I kind of, yeah, I wanted to, I guess, memorialize that, and, you know, was thinking so much about legacy, and I was really worried about, you know, being, yeah, without them all, what was coming as well. You know, it's quite a suspended period, the 5 years after my mum died, before my dad died, because I kind of, you know, I knew that more was coming. So we recorded a lot of audio. We also eventually made a film together about my mum, and, well, about my sister as well. And, you know, it was a really great time, because I think for him it was also a platform to talk and share some of his grief, which I don't think he'd had an outlet for in quite that way. And it was really meaningful and really poignant.
I remember the first time I heard songs that have changed my life. That's because of her. It takes me straight back to those years. She was my everything. No one loved me like she did. When Sonny loved you, the whole world was conquerable. Dancing and dressing sharp was our thing. I dance every day to keep our thing going and to hold that momentum of our bond. These tiny rituals of joy amidst such heavy years.
One of the other elements amongst the different ones is the power of dancing and music as a kind of embodied the healing in some way. You know, it isn't just talking.
Yeah, absolutely.
It has to be somehow, you know, we're living beings, aren't we? And we live in bodies, and they can have, you know, work for the good or ill. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, the book that I made around dancing was very much a love letter to my sister Sonia, and, you know, how we grew up around mixtapes and dancing and sort of, you know, togetherness and the full sort of spectrum of emotions, you know, because it wasn't, you know, when you like have siblings, it's definitely not all joy and, you know, wow, amazing sort of times. But there were beautiful memories within the standard sisterly things of kind of, yeah. That was a sort of a very unifying, music was very unifying for us. And then, you know, as my work has gone more into the public realm, we engage with the public and we listen to the public with everything that we put out there, and particularly as things become less static and more conceptual, you know, we're like this year we're doing a touring discotheca thing that's sort of going around to encourage people to shake out their grief and all the intersections of grief through dancing. And this is in response to, you know, listening to the public and kind of having lots of engagement with the public last year, and them saying that verbal communication and verbal sort of expressions of grief is actually is exhausting within the current climate. So, you know, this need to sort of physically shake out varying degrees of pain and grief and maintain mental health is very popular at the, you know, so we've just sort of listened to that.
So if I, just to get a sense of how discotheca works,
yeah.
So it's traveling around the country, it's a thing, it's a physical thing, or
so there's the sort of the original iteration is a kiosk which was built in 1967 or designed in 1967 in Slovenia, and they were kind of quite big across the Eastern Bloc, and they were sort of used for coffee shops and bars and cafes and sort of ways to bring people together. They're modular and kind of amazing 60s creations in their own right. And there's a company in Berlin that restores them and sort of maintains that legacy, and also in a beautiful way, which was really interesting. And we have sort of repurposed a kiosk as a discotheca. That's coming to London at the end of July, the 25th to the 30th, in Canary Wharf. And that's sort of the original iteration. And then from there, we're running kind of off-site, like sort of discotheca things at various festivals across the country. So yeah, that's that really. But it's very much based around dancing. We've also kind of integrated a whole movement program. I work with a woman who heads up the Loss Project, and she does all the programming for these installations. And so everything is, you know, the full program is movement based, but we aim to kind of cater for every intersection of grief. And by that, I also mean, you know, climate grief and political grief and that kind of, you know, speaking to bereavement and loss of lifestyle and, you know, the many different losses, not assuming that we'll be dealing with anyone at any one time, that there might be a more complex thing going on, which I think there often is for people.
Mm-hmm. So would I come along with, just to clarify, because I'm thinking of what to bring, like I could come along with some Elvis, as it were, for my mum.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Do you know what I mean? Is that the kind of thing, like it's like, literally, could you put Suspicious Minds on? and I can kind of have my little moment, imagining myself in my front room. And
yeah.
You know, because music's so powerful, isn't it? There's dancing is one thing. And then there's what music does, and that kind of direct, non-rational, as it were, access that music gives you is I really like the idea, basically, is what I'm saying. I think it's a really great idea of bringing those two things together. And because they do have as well as a memory stimulant, they are kind of healing, you know, moving and letting go. And
yeah.
And is that been the experience? I mean, what's the kind of feedback you've been getting, I suppose, is what I mean.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we've been running, as part of this program, we've been running events called Grief Raves, which is exactly that, where we encourage people to bring vinyl tapes or CDs down to wherever we're invited to be, and sort of play those and dedicate those to whoever or whatever the person is missing, and to maybe share a story if they wanted to also about that person or that thing or that event, or a combination of things. And I guess we're sort of trying to strike the balance between the individual and the collective, because, you know, when you do that, that's obviously a very sort of individual and very personal, often very personal memory. But in bringing people together to sort of dance through that, then it sort of becomes collective. So I think it's sort of how you build a wider grief, you know, togetherness and grief family, if you like, and how you do that respectfully and carefully, you know, is a sort of a big job.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose the obvious, thing, we've just come through COVID.
Yeah.
So the kind of collective nature and understanding of loss, whether it's a personal loss in terms of someone who we've loved and been close to who died during COVID or because of COVID, but also, as you said earlier, the loss of lifestyle, loss of certain freedoms, loss of assumptions about what future is, you know. And there are many, again, you've mentioned climate change, and these are all kind of ominous threats to our future. You know, so there is a kind of, grief, I agree, is all over. And I think the fact that you have managed to take something extraordinarily personal and tragic and then expand it out in creative ways is a gift, really. Well, it is, you know, it's a very generous act. To make something is a generous act. To make something out of some sort of shared affection, it's a very generous thing.
I think, you know, this sort of loss and grief, you know, maybe not, as I say, identically, the same identical experience to what we've had as a family, but I think, you know, grief and loss and pain are integral parts of the human condition. And I think, you know, alongside joy and life and birth and, you know, all of these things. And so I think, you know, making that part of the sort of spectrum of living can be a really binding thing, and also really important as well, you know, that we find a kind of fluidity of language around that, because we have that around life, we have that around birth, we have that around joy, you know. So, you know, and I think grief and death and loss are inevitabilities of life. So I think, you know, being able to sort of integrate that and, you know, have a bit more of a through line in our language and narrative as well is it's also really binding, you know, as a people for us.
No, I agree. I think you're right. If I pop down, what would I find you spinning on the wheels, as they say?
I guess it sort of depends on who it's for, because I have like quite a personal relationship with music with each of them, actually. But just thinking, the first thing that came to mind was my mum. And I was thinking of Mr. Bojangles from Nina Simone. It's definitely a Harriet song. So
top tune.
Yeah, yeah.
You also had an ice cream van, I believe, that you you took around. I wonder whether you could say a little bit about that and some of the conversations that you encountered.
Yeah, that was immediately post-pandemic, so 2021. And we wanted to do something that was just about sort of joy and playfulness and bringing people together in, you know, according to whatever the rules were at that time, a sort of ageless, classless thing that people could, you know, where people could come and talk about their grief and their experience of the pandemic on, you know, any level that they wanted to. So again, this sort of non-prescriptive thing of, you know, you could just come and have an ice cream, or you could come and have an ice cream and you could sit down with a therapist, or you could engage in a workshop, or, you know, you could do all of those things. And sometimes people didn't know what they wanted to do until they got there. We tried to sort of, yeah, create a program that would accommodate all of those things. And we reached, you know, hundreds and thousands of people over a couple of years, and we took it to New York in a slightly different form. But yeah, it was really beautiful.
Sounds brilliant. I had an idea of a grief taxi once.
Oh.
The taxi would be a two-tone Merc, an old 1960s 240D Merc, red and white. I had it all planned out. And a grief cab.
Love this.
A great idea,
love
isn't
this.
It?
We should talk more about
this. We should definitely talk more about this.
Yeah.
So you get your cab, but actually, you know, it's a non-professional sort of therapeutic ride.
I love this. That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, you know, I got it. So as soon as I saw the ice cream thing, it was like, oh, well, that's even better. You get ice cream.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we need to combine these.
That was exactly my thought. But I think you've done an amazing thing. I think you were doing amazing things. And goodness knows how many folks you've helped, you know, by doing what you're doing. You know, and maybe you know it, maybe you don't even think of it in those terms. But I think you are, and thank you.
Oh, really, thank you.
For doing
thank
what you've done. I really, really appreciate your honesty, your directness, your intelligence, and your commitment.
Oh, thank you so thank much. You it's been really much. Lovely talking. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Life and Death podcast. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospice.org.uk, where there is an array of resources to support people who are experiencing grief and bereavement. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do let us know. Send us a message on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just search Ashgate Hospice. You've been listening to the Life and Death podcast. I've been your host, Stephen Rumford. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.